She thought the slide-down visor was some kind of metal blast shield, but turning it over, she saw it was tinted glass. The exterior had been treated with some process that had left it frosted and opaque. Inside, there was no padding or inner liner, just the buckles and press studs needed to fit one. A silt of fine dust winnowed out of the helmet as she turned it over. "Can we patch up some power?" Teller asked. Gothlin moved up, found a wall box, and tried to rig in the man-portable Jenny. Nothing happened. "Are the connectors clean?" asked Teller. Gothlin played her flashlight inside. "Clean as, sir," she said. "Cleaner than the boxes on the Montoro." Teller saw the torch beam glinting off metal that was polished to an almost chrome finish. "Hang on, back, back," Teller said, directing Gothlin to pan her torch around again. There was no trunking coming off the box. No cables, no wall lines, no ducting. Just a faint, grubby streak where the power trunking had once been run along the wall. A few metal cable fasteners remained in place. "They stripped out all the wiring?" asked Gothlin. "Maybe they needed it for a fix somewhere else," said Belfi. Teller shook his head. "Doesn't look like it was stripped out," he said. "It's just gone." They cut through four more hatches to reach the control deck. Behind the third one, Belfi's lamp picked up something on the floor, small metal objects catching the light. "What is it?" asked Teller. Belfi crouched down and picked the little items up. He cupped them in his hand. "Looks like a belt buckle and a wedding ring and... what are these?" Teller took a look. The tiny things looked familiar. Out of context, it took a moment to place them. "Eyelets," he said.
"What now?"
"Eyelets. Metal eyelets for laces. From a pair of boots." The control deck was dark. They moved between the console stations and seats.
"Are those windows?"
asked Rogers, panning her torch beam.
"Should be," said Teller.
"Sergeant," Rogers called, "see if we can get the storm shields up."
"On it," said Bose.
"There's trunking here," said Gothlin. "There's cables and wiring. These consoles look pretty much intact."
"See if you can boost one into life," said Teller. "Concentrate on archive, log, data link."
Gothlin got to work.
"Lieutenant," Bose called out.
"Yep."
"The storm shields are open."
Teller and Rogers crossed to the back of windows at the front of the deck. They were black, as though the external shutters were down.
"Are you sure?" asked Teller.
"Positive," said Bose.
"So is that the storm?" asked Rogers.
"No. There's something wrong with the glass," replied Bose.
Teller unhooked his goggles and shone his torch at them. The glass was almost opaque. The glare coating was gone. The external surface looked like it had been rubbed with an abrasive scourer. Billions of micro-scratches fogged the lenses.
"The dust did that?" asked Rogers.
There was a flicker of light and a mechanical chatter. Gothlin had patched in the portable power unit and woken up the master control.
"What have we got?" asked Teller, coming over.
"Not much of anything, sir," said Gothlin. "Memory's been dumped or backed up someplace I can't access. No logs."
"Data link?" asked Rogers.
"Maybe,"
replied Gothlin at work. "Try automated task record," said Teller. "The harvester would record its own routes to make sure it matched quotas."
"Good call," said Gothlin. "That would be stored automatically and pretty much tamper-proof."
She typed, and data scrolled across the screens. It was hard to read. Rogers tried to wipe the soot off the monitor glass, but it wasn't soot. It was ground-in distortion. Gothlin peered.
"Okay, we have a track monitor. That column is the time code, day-to-day, hour-by-hour. That's yield. That sidebar there is coordinates, so we can map from that. So let's see."
"Nothing for the last 3 weeks.
Nada.
No track record at all.
I guess that's how long this baby's been dead out here."
"What's the last log?" asked Rogers.
3 weeks, but it's incomplete and runs incomplete for the 9 weeks prior to that. The tractor was moving for those 9 weeks, but no yield was taken, or nothing logged anyway. There's a code here. Hang on. Let me try and work this out. There should be a key. That code repeats at every track entry through the 9-week period.
Okay, yeah, it means off designated course.
So the consist was moving for 9 weeks off pattern? Asked Teller.
That matches the data collected by the company, said Rogers. Diverted from harvest route and no answer as to why.
At the start of that 9-week period? Asked Teller.
What's that?
There was an unusually dense block of data.
Goughlin typed some more.
That's the malfunction, she said.
The causal event, murmured Rogers.
Details? Asked Teller.
Okay, hello. Looks like the consist hit something. It was harvesting and it ran into something in the crop. Some light damage to the blades, nothing systematic, but it hit something big.
There's a file attached.
Open it, said Teller. Goughlin grinned up at him.
Already on it, she said.
Pictures opened on screen. Blurry low-res pics taken from a flyer. They could see the tractor, an aerial view. The endless landscape of the crop like an ocean. The weather had been better then. This had been before the storms. There was something in the crop ahead of the tractor. A large, dark mass half buried in the deep corn.
Zoom it? Asked Teller.
No, but there's a close-up or two,
Goughlin replied. She opened more pictures.
What the hell is that? Asked Teller.
The storm had suddenly eased. Waiting in the lead-drop cockpit, Kennedy suddenly realized that light levels were rising. The black soup of weather was slowly resolving into an eerie amber twilight. The wind was dropping. The drop was no longer vibrating on its stand. He looked out. There was still dust in the air, and the light was stained, as though pale smoke was shrouding the sun. He could see out beyond the lip of the Baylor housing platform. He could see the ground. It looked bare and gray.
"This is Kennedy," he said into the mic. "The storm's dropping right now. I've got some visibility."
"Copy that, Kennedy," Rogers crackled back over the link.
"How's it looking in there?"
"We're still trying to piece it together," Rogers replied.
"You want me to take a look around out here? I can't see much from the cockpit."
"Okay, but be careful and check in with Drop 2 first."
"Copy that," he replied.
He switched channels.
"Drop 2, Drop 2, this is lead drop. Drop 2, Drop 2, do you copy? This is lead drop. Do you copy?"
Dead air hissed back at him.
"Drop 2, Drop 2, requesting sit rep from Captain Broom. Drop 2, what is your status? Have you reached the Demeter?"
"Atmospherics," Kennedy reasoned. "The weather."
He left the channel open, replugged his headset to mobile, and unstrapped. Outside, a breeze was gusting, tugging at him. Fine dust like flour swirling in the air. Beyond the Baylor housing, the world was lit amber. A dead sky hung over dead land, all hazed by the powder dust. He figured he could see about one, maybe two clicks before it got too murky. The wide prairies of LVKR-115 dwarfed anything on Earth. Flat and unimpeded by geographical feature, they made an ideal site for bulk crop production. Weyland-Yutani had terraformed the soil, boosting nitrate levels, and then sown a robust strain of genetically modified high-yield wheat across the entire northern and western territories. The strain was self-seeding. Crop would follow crop on a self-germinating cycle. The company proudly claimed that LVKR-115 would render annual overlapping harvests for a 90-year period before another round of terraforming was required to renitrate the soil. So where was the crop, he wondered. The consist had wandered off course. This region hadn't been systematically harvested. But there was no wheat out there. As far as he could see, the ground was bare and black.
"What is it?"
asked Rogers.
"Some kind of pit?"
"Is it natural?" asked Bowes. "Like a sinkhole or something?"
Teller looked at the pictures.
"That doesn't look natural," he said.
"Well, it looks organic. Like it was made."
The cavity in the pictures was deep, and maybe 50 meters across. The earth around its mouth was folded into disturbingly organic puckers. It looked like a throat, or similar body cavity.
"Looks like the tractor hit it and took the top right off," said Goughlin.
"Unplugged it."
"And let something out," said Rogers.
"Why the hell are you saying that, Rogers?" asked Bowes.
Because it looks like a nest, she replied.
Is this a bug hunt? Asked Belfi.
Damn it, don't tell me this is a bug hunt.
We don't know anything yet, said Teller. He drew Rogers to one side.
You know something I don't? He asked.
I know Kennedy can't raise the Demeter or drop two, she replied.
Okay, but I don't mean about that. She shrugged.
I grew up in the Southwest, she said. I know what a termite nest looks like. Anthills, too.
Great, but this, termites can remain dormant for decades, she said. That's locusts.
Well, whatever, the same applies. If this is an unknown exotic life form nest, it could have been dormant a long time. The harvester blades its top off, thing wakes up. If there's a feeding cycle, the company has provided an entire planet's worth of crops.
Weyland-Yutani would have detected something like that during survey in the TF program.
Yeah, Roger said, because as we know, they never make any mistakes. The Consus woke something up. It's picking everything clean. Organics, clothes, fabrics, trunking, boots.
He looked sick suddenly.
People, he said. Everything's stripped back to bare metal. The crew seal themselves in, deeper and deeper. The exotic life forms eat away everything until they destroy the harvester systems and leave it dead.
So they sealed themselves in this control room? Okay, where are they?
Teller looked around as Bose put a hand on his arm.
Look at this, he said.
There were storage lockers at the back of the control deck. Searching, Bose and Belfi had been forced to cut them open because they had been torch-welded shut from inside. God alone knew what fate had befallen the rest of the 68 crew, but the last four had died here inside the lockers, sealed in coffins of their own manufacture. Teller stared at the shriveled remains. Starvation, he thought. Starvation and dehydration.
Why didn't they cut themselves out again? Asked Gofflin, wide-eyed. They had cutters.
Because they didn't know it was safe to come out, said Rogers. They didn't dare.
We're aborting, said Teller. Everyone back to the drop.
If this is a bug hunt, Ben protested.
We can... No, we absolutely can't, said Teller. If Rogers is right, we're dealing with an immense exotic predator. But it's not one target. It's composed of countless tiny individuals.
You're a good shot, Sergeant. How much ammo did you bring? How do you rate your chances in target practice against a swarm of space locusts?
Shit, said Bose.
The company will have to bomb LVKR-115 with pesticides, said Rogers.
The whole planet? Asked Belfi.
The freak weather, said Rogers quietly. I think it's catastrophic atmospheric disturbance caused by the sheer size of the swarm.
Are you shitting me? Asked Pater.
Think about it. These space bugs sleep for years, then wake up and feed. Probably used to raise the old grasslands and then sleep again until the vegetation regrew. Life cycle. But the company fixed this planet with endless, fast-growing, self-replicating crop yields. A never-ending food supply. Can you even imagine how big the swarm has got with nothing to limit or inhibit its growth?
Jesus Christ, murmured O'Dowd.
We didn't hit weather on the way down, said Teller. We hit the pressure wave of the swarm. Kennedy leaned out over the edge of the Baylor platform and craned his neck. He could see the side of the crop tractor's hull. He expected to see the same bright yellow paintwork that featured in the brochure pictures they had all examined at brief. In the ghastly amber light, the side of the hull looked like bare metal. He reached over and touched the surface of the hull. It was rough. It was bare metal. Bare metal that felt like it had been sandblasted. A shadow fell across him. He looked up. The storm was coming back. The sky was black, and visibility was dropping fast. Sudden, strong wind blasted at him. A wall of darkness was rushing across the bare earth towards the tractor. It was churning up gritty clouds of dust and dry soil in front of it. The wall itself, a kilometer high or more, was a seething, boiling black mass, iridescent. Battered by the wind, Kennedy staggered back to the drop's ramp. He clung on to the stanchion, afraid he was going to be dragged off his feet by the wind force. There was grit everywhere. He'd taken off his mask and goggles, and he could feel his hands and face were bloody and raw. He couldn't breathe. The wall hit the harvester. There was no time to cry out. Billions of small black shapes billowed around Kennedy. He vanished, shredded. A body armor shoulder plate hit the deck, the metal innards of an earpiece mic. A belt buckle, polished brightly. Hurrying down the service way towards the Baylor housing, they all felt the Consus rock hard. The entire bulk of it was shaking. Howling wind screamed down the hallways through the hatches they had cut open on their way in.
"Back!" Teller yelled. "Back!"
"To what?" shouted Bose.
Teller didn't know what to say.
"The lockers?"
Roger offered at the top of her voice. The idea was appalling, unthinkable. But they all realized how it might have been the only option. The only viable chance. The idea was academic anyway. The control deck was two floors away, and the storm was already on them, roaring up the service way towards them in an engulfing flash flood of gleaming darkness. They ran away, without hope. All except Bose.
He turned, aimed his pulse rifle at the oncoming blizzard, and opened fire.
It was all he could do. The last thing he would do. Be a Marine. Be Corps. Take as many of the enemy down with him as he could. He was still yelling and firing when the storm engulfed him.
Broken by Rachel Kane. On. It was the first word he said, and at the same time he opened his eyes. They worked perfectly, of course, but the data that his optics streamed came in a flood and took a moment to process. The moment was approximately a nanosecond, and then he blinked, because blinking delivered moisturizing lubricant to his eyes and made them look flawlessly human at the same time. He knew he was not human. That knowledge had been hard-coded into him, along with a variety of terms for what he was. Android. Synthetic. Robot. Artificial person. He decided he was an artificial person, and as he did, he smiled, focused on the person standing across from him, and said, "Hello." The person ignored him to tap on a data tablet. She was loud, he realized, and dialed his inputs back to acceptable levels where the pulsing roar of her heartbeat and rush of blood and gurgle of nutrient processing and creaking bellows of her lungs no longer distracted him. Now he only heard the tap of her fingers on the pad, the hum of electronics all around him, the whisper of the air recycling system. A great deal of inputs, but his brain flawlessly processed, identified, and stored each one. The woman, his first real person, had a slight frown on her face, and he checked his database, widened his eyes to the correct pre-programmed amount, shifted the timbre of his voice to a warmer, deeper setting as he asked, "Are you in some distress? How can I help?" She glanced up from the data pad, and he felt something flash through him like a faulty circuit. What was that? Processing caught up an instant later and identified it as emotion. She seemed irritated, and he was sorry. Her shoulders had gone stiff, and that body language conformed to... to what? Suspicion? Designation HS17B48XG5-D5. Your name is now Bishop. Do you acknowledge? Her voice was a complex marvel of harmonics, one he stored to examine later, but she had asked him a question, and he immediately answered. Acknowledged, Dr. Sasaki. I'm pleased to meet you. Her frown deepened. I didn't tell you my name. I'm sorry, Dr. Sasaki. I read your name tag. I hope that's all right. He smiled again. This seemed to be the right expression for the occasion, and he chose one that the database identified as wistful. Have I done something wrong? She seemed to debate that for a very long time, with her finger hovering over her data pad, and then shook her head. No, Bishop, you haven't. Please join the others. She pointed across the room, a very plain, empty room with nothing in it but Dr. Sasaki, who also wore white, a form-fitting skin of material that wrapped up around her head in a hood to conceal her hair. and the only other shades in the room were the black letters of her name tag under the embossed seal of the Weyland-Yutani Corporation. The color of her skin, amber, and her eyes, which matched a shade his database identified as dark brown. Even the datapad was the same stark white, at least on the side he could see. Bishop turned while processing all that to look where she indicated. There was a doorway behind him and beyond it another room. Instead of moving toward it, he looked down because he detected that the area on which he stood resonated at a different frequency. It was a round section that was hollow beneath and bisected in the middle. "What is that, Dr. Sasaki?" he asked, and then immediately clarified because he had been imprecise. "What am I standing on?" "You're a curious one," she said, and there was a change in her voice now. Another resonant shift he'd have to save for examination. "That's the failsafe. There is a very small chance that upon activation, a synthetic such as yourself may exhibit signs of instability." "I see," Bishop said, still staring down. "It opens. Where does it go?" "The chute leads to a machine that disassembles defective units to constituent parts for reuse." He was standing over an execution chamber. Bishop stepped off the circle. It wasn't a conscious decision. It was one his volume processor, his brain, had simply ordered in the interest of self-preservation. The artificial organ that regulated the flow of hydraulic fluid through his trunk, head, and limbs had increased its rate of flow. He didn't want to die. "Thank you, Dr. Sasaki," he said, because he had been programmed to be polite, and walked into the next room. Behind him, he heard Dr. Sasaki give a deep, trembling sigh and whisper something in a language he identified as Japanese. "I should have flushed him." Another flicker of emotion raced through him, this one subtly different, a new one. Sadness. There were four other artificial persons seated in the next room. All of them looked identical to him in form and coloring, except that they were dressed in gray clothing with the Weyland-Yutani corporate logo on the collars, and he had nothing except his synthetic skin. "Hello," he said. "My name is Bishop." All four stood up, flawlessly synchronized. He heard the pitch of data exchange, inaudible to human hearing as they coordinated actions, and then one said, "I am Rook." The others were named Castle, King, and Knight. "Someone likes chess," Bishop said, and smiled, because he felt a pulse of what he identified as amusement. It was followed by disquiet when none of the rest smiled back. They simply stared, clinically analyzing him, cataloging, dissecting. "Our names are based on chess terms," Knight replied. It was Bishop's voice, but the inflections were flat, uninspired, lifeless. "I am not sure why that implies someone likes chess." "Then I can't help you," Bishop said. He took in more data. The room was white, like the last, only there were no fail-safes in the floor, and there were two stiff white couches that could seat three each. A low table in the middle, also white, he was, he realized, finding the decorating uninspired, held a neatly folded cloth jumpsuit like the one his brothers, could he call them brothers, also wore. He took it and pulled it on over his synthetic epidermis with quick, efficient motions, pulled the zipper shut and said, "What do we do now?" The others sat down on the couches, perfectly synchronized. He heard the dataset sync calling to him to join them, but instead, Bishop continued to stand and folded his arms. Identical sets of eyes stared at him, medium brown, not as dark as Dr. Sasaki's, and he studied the identical worn features of their faces. Pale skin, high arching forehead with a shock of brown hair, deep-set lines bracketing nose and mouth. Looking at the other four seemed like looking at strangers, not a mirror. The others turned their heads in unison toward the closed door at the far end. He heard the activation code being entered, too, but waited until the portal slid open before he shifted his gaze to it. A young, bulky man, a real person, bored and annoyed, leaned in and said, "Move out. You're being shipped." "Shipped where?" Bishop asked. The man seemed startled, and then he frowned, the same as Dr. Sasaki had. "My responses are outside the normal parameters," he thought, "but not so far outside that I was sent to my death down the chute. What did that make him? Defective? Strange? Different," he thought. "I'm different." He waited for the emotion to come, and it did. A bright flash he identified as satisfaction. "Shut up and walk," the man said, and Bishop did. But where the other four walked in precise rhythm, he made sure his steps were a bit longer, a bit out of sync. Different.
"Holy fuck, watch your field of fire!"
Lieutenant Larson screamed it at Private Peekskill, who'd sprayed a deadly burst of bullets too close to a screaming knot of civilians. There were dozens of them, all spread out flat or crouched down or already dead in the firefight. At least five lay sprawled on the bullet-chewed wooden floor, spotlit by a broken skylight. Bishop, unarmed, crouched behind a pillar next to Larson. The rest of their squad, including Peekskill, were pinned down on the other side of the common hall that had once doubled as the brand-new Ha'arsa Colony Marketplace. Bishop still saw grace in the arching lines of the concrete pillars, and the glass-tile mosaic on the far wall, damaged by gunfire and bomb fragments, showed real merit. Ha'arsa was planned to be a showplace for the terraforming division of Weyland-Yutani. There were a total of 47 colonists here already, and, by his calculations, half were now dead in some part of the facility or other. This wasn't going to reflect well on next quarter's profit and loss statements. "Sorry, Lou," Peekskill yelled back and opened fire on a balcony somewhere overhead. Bishop turned down his hearing as the bullets pounded into concrete, wood, glass, and steel above, shattering store windows and severing power lines with showers of sparks, and finally Peekskill managed to find at least one soft target. Even muted, Bishop heard the difference when bullets ripped through flesh, bone, and organs. "He got one of them," Bishop reported quietly to Lieutenant Larson, which was probably unnecessary since Peekskill gave a wild whoop of victory across the way. Bishop ignored that to listen to other things. "The rest are retreating, sir. I don't think we're going to dig them out this way, and we don't have a lot of time. Has the corporation considered paying them?" The soldiers currently occupying Ha'arsa Colony were criminals who called themselves Company F. Company F recruited former colonial Marines, mercs, anyone who met their standards of moral absence and greed. Their methodology was, Bishop thought, objectively brilliant. They landed on an otherwise hard-working, peaceful settlement, took hostages, killed as many as it took to get their point across, and made a financial demand to the Weyland-Yutani Corporation, or whichever rival company owned the terraformed colony. It was a quick payoff, and the pirates moved on to pillage another day. Only this time it had gone wrong, simply because a complement of colonial marines under the command of Lieutenant Lucky Larson had been less than half a day's flight out after refueling. And Weyland-Yutani had decided that it wasn't paying Company F any more bounties. "Well, fuck me," Larson said in disgust. He was a short man, blocky, with a scar bisecting his face almost exactly down the middle, but twisting over his nose like a seam not pulled straight. He also had thick burn scars running up the left side of his neck. Lucky Larson, his soldiers called him, for obvious reasons. "How many left in Company F, Bishop?" "Minus the one that Private Peekskill just killed, I count at least 30, sir, holding 11 hostages, including 4 children." Company F liked holding children, under the theory that it forced a faster payout. While it didn't make Bishop angry, it did make him... what was that exact emotion? Disgusted. "Too many for us to dig out without losses of our own, and we've got our orders," the lieutenant said. He seemed especially grim, Bishop thought. "Right, time to get these people out. Bishop, take point. Get the ones who can walk to the transport and on the ship. Check the wounded, then tag the ones you think are worth cryo. But remember, we only have 12 extra chambers. Yes, sir. Bishop stood up, but he didn't immediately follow the order, even though that priority was clear. Sir, if we're not going after Company F, how do we rescue the hostages? We don't, Larson said. Orders are to blow the central converters and evac. I don't understand. If we destroy the central converters, it'll flood the central complex with Prevox gas. Everyone will be dead if they can't get to masks. Dead painfully, Bishop thought, but didn't add. Larson knew how Prevox worked. It was a vital component in the terraforming process, but it was volatile and dangerous. Lucky for us, the masks are smart linked, so even if they do make it to the cabinets, the masks won't work. Ibarra already locked them down. Bishop felt the artificial muscles of his face contracting, forming his expression into a pinched frown. That means everyone dies, even the hostages. Yeah, Bishop, no shit, that's what it means. It happens, and there's nothing we can do about it. Now go get these people out. That's an order. We have to save those we can. Larson, Bishop realized, didn't like this either. Not at all. But he had orders. Real people had the ability to disobey an order, but in Bishop's observation, they rarely did. Not when there were real consequences along with the action. It was almost as if there were no real distinctions between real people, biologicals, he called them, but only privately, and artificials. At least an artificial person had the excuse of being programmed. Bishop weighed the odds of persuading Larson to go against orders and decided that they weren't good. Larson wasn't afraid to kill, and he wasn't afraid of civilian casualties. He had a pragmatic outlook to war, and as far as he was concerned, Ha'arsa colony had just become a war zone. Innocents were bound to die, and his job was to make sure his soldiers survived. So Bishop walked out into the open atrium, spoke calmly and quietly to the frightened colonists, and sent them with Peekskill's soldiers back to the ship as he methodically checked each of the fallen. 7 dead, 2 so gravely wounded that even cryosleep and the best medical attention wasn't going to save them. That left 10 for the cryo chambers, and Bishop used comms to call for transport. Larson left him to it and followed a map to the central control room. Bishop calmly reassured the wounded, those who could hear him, that they would be evacuated and treated, and they were in no danger. He tried not to listen to the cries of the ones he'd red-tagged as too far gone. He wasn't wrong about their chances at life. It wasn't a judgment call. They were dying, and nothing could stop it. So when the 2 company medics, Patel and Luo, arrived and began loading the yellow tags on stretchers, it was odd that he felt it necessary to go and talk to those who were being left behind, to tell them that everything was all right. He didn't tell them they were dying. One of them died while he was with them. One ceased functioning before he could get to him. When he looked up, he was the only one standing, and the atrium seemed utterly still now, with only the rush of wind through the broken skylight. The dead were as silent as the broken, bullet-marked concrete. Bishop! He looked up. Larson was leaning over the balcony, staring down. Everybody out? Yes, Lieutenant. Then what the fuck are you doing? Get to the ship! We have less than 5 minutes before the converters blow. Bishop considered that. The calculations took nanoseconds, but he already knew before the results came in what he was going to do. Maybe he was, after all, defective. A true artificial person didn't make a decision in advance of data calculations. I can take a supply of functioning masks with me, enough for the hostages. I can get to them in time. No, I don't need to breathe. Bishop, I said no. You're an asset, and I'm not leaving you to get reprogrammed by Company F or shot full of holes. You know how much you cost? Bishop blinked. Not because he needed the lubrication, but because he had to reorganize his information. Lieutenant Larson doesn't see me as part of his team. I'm an asset. A machine. An expensive machine that he'll get in trouble for losing. It was the same cold math that Weyland Yutani used to decide that they could afford to lose Ha'arsa Colony and every human being inside it, to stop Company F and make it clear they weren't paying ransoms any longer. They were sending the message in blood, and Lieutenant Larson was willing to write it for them, but not in synthetic blood. Bishop, an artificial person, turned away and walked out of the atrium, down a sloping corridor, and let Larson's shouts echo behind him. He knew Larson wouldn't come after. For all the shouts, Larson wasn't stupid. He wouldn't risk his life for this. If Bishop succeeded, he'd take credit. If Bishop failed, he'd blame the pirates. He heard Larson's footsteps running for the exit as he reached the first emergency life cabinet and tore it open. The neatly ranked life support masks all showed red indicators, which meant they were indeed disabled, but Bishop took them one at a time, cracked the processor casing, snapped the tiny filament that locked out changes, and used his onboard data sync to flash program them again. There were 11 hostages. He took 11 masks, stuffed them into an expandable bag from his pack, and broke into a run deeper into the bowels of Ha'arsa Colony. The secure area door he found was too thick to batter down, but he ran a password breaker, intended only for official use, on the keypad and had it open in 15 seconds. The timer he ran as a faint display on his left eye showed him that he had less than 2 minutes left before the converters blew out. It would take time for the gas to reach toxic levels, but Prevox bound to oxygen, which meant everyone breathing would suffocate well before the toxins killed them. The children will die faster. He tried to calculate how much faster, but without more information it was imprecise, and he erased the calculations and ran faster, stretching lab-grown tendons and pumping hydraulics at a redline rate. It was good he was moving so fast, because the first bullets missed him by quite a large margin, and he shifted course and dove behind the cover of a corner as another weapon roared. Concrete chipped and flew in knife-edged shards. He felt a cut and looked down to see that his synthetic epidermis was sliced across the top of his hand, leaking a thin stream of thick white fluid. It revealed a marvel of strong, pale synth-engineered tendons, pistons, data channels, glistening hair-thin wires. If he'd had time, he'd have been fascinated. Instead, he opened a kit at his belt, took out a small can, and sprayed skin over the gap. It had an ugly look, but he'd fix it later, if there was a later. "Hey, Marine!" someone yelled around the corner. "How does it feel to be another gun for hire for the suits? You take an oath to the corporations now?" Bishop didn't answer because he was distracted, not by his wound, but by something else. A sensation like a tapping on his brain. He'd felt it before, but not for years. Not since the day he was born. "He's not a colonial marine," said a very familiar voice. His own voice. "He's a synthetic, like me." The sensation he was feeling was a sync link trying to connect. They were programmed that way, to share data across models. He rejected the sync and said in a calm tone that was somehow entirely different from his brother's, "Not like you, Rook." "His name is Bishop," Rook said to the others on his side of the corner. "He isn't a threat. We are not programmed to fight. He won't even have a weapon." That much was true. Bishop didn't like guns. He'd never really thought of that as programming, but it probably was. Still, he wasn't Rook. "We can always use another synth," the other voice said, the one that wasn't a mirror image of his own. "Come on out, Bishop, we won't shoot. Consider yourself a new member of Company F." "It's not that easy," Rook said, and he still had the same strange cadence, the same monotone delivery that Bishop remembered. Just enough wrong to make Bishop think, "But am I really right?" "He's been programmed for loyalty to the core. You'll need to reprogram him." "Like they did you?" Bishop asked. That got a general wave of cold laughter. "Nah, we didn't have to push a button. This is Key Parker, by the way, leader of Company F. Old Rook, he was ours to begin with.
Got shot up on a mission. They scrapped him. We salvaged him. You're with Lucky Larson, right? Damn, small universe. I was there when he got his face sliced open. Ugly enough to make me want to puke. Company F's just like the Marines, only we pay more. What do you say, Bishop? You in?
Sure, Bishop said. As long as you release the hostages, you have... He flipped the timer back to visible. 17 seconds. There was a murmur among the soldiers, and a woman said, "The fuck?" While someone else said, "Fucking synths, we should just take him for parts." And a hostage began to cry. 16. 15. 14. At 10, Bishop calmly called the time again and said, "What does Company F stand for?" "Company F for fuck you, and also fuck your countdown, synth. Step out and we won't shoot. Stay there and we'll cut you to pieces." That wasn't the plan, which Bishop knew because sync link or not, he was somehow aware of Rook moving. Rook was circling around to come in behind him, most likely to take him prisoner, but possibly to shoot him in the back. Bishop turned, ran in the direction Rook would be coming, and timed it to turn the corner just as his brother, his mirror image, reached it. Face to face again. Except they weren't mirrors anymore, if they ever had been. Rook looked expressionless, plastic, lifeless, though he moved like a person. Bishop was undecided on the human concept of souls, but a look into Rook's empty eyes was enough to show that his brother definitely didn't possess one. Rook didn't hesitate. He lunged forward and there was a knife in his hand, a black combat model with a 6-inch blade. Bishop met him halfway, twisting that hand enough that the stab missed him. Then he slammed the heel of his palm into the spots where he knew Rook was vulnerable. He'd taken time to learn his own vulnerabilities. And in 3 seconds, Rook was down, the knife skittering away from his open hand. Bishop knelt on his spine, picked up the knife, and said, "I'm sorry," before he plunged the knife down into just the right spot to sever the nexus that fed instructions from the brain to the limbs. Rook wasn't dead. He just couldn't move. Eventually, he'd power down, and finally, in several human lifetimes, he'd go completely dark. Bishop stood, flipped the knife expertly end over end, and caught it by the blade before slipping it into his belt. "Just because you're not programmed for something doesn't mean you can't learn it," he told Rook, though Rook was long past learning anything. The head was turned sideways and one eye stared up at him. The mouth opened and closed, but nothing except a gout of white hydraulic fluid came out. Bishop watched the timer, and when it reached zero, he crouched down against the wall. He'd calculated this part, too. This wall was mathematically the least likely to be damaged by the blast. Boom. That was how they wrote the sound in books he'd read, but it wasn't a boom, really. It was a roar, and deep and shuddering thunder that rattled the entire complex, shattered structural bones, and tore through his body like a solid blow. Bishop thought of the ruined beauty of the marketplace. It would be gone now, and those he'd red-tagged and witnessed dying would be buried in ruins. The blast had hit the opposite corner hard. Bishop restarted the counter. He had less than a minute to get these masks on the hostages, if they survived. He ran that direction and came to a fast skidding stop when he saw most of Company F was lying dead, crushed and broken and bleeding. But there were 4 or 5 still standing, and they were all aiming weapons at him. "It's Rook," he said, and kept his voice the mirror of his crippled brother's. Flat, unfeeling, and, above all, calm. He drew the knife from his belt and showed it to them, then put it on the ground. "Bishop's dead." One of the soldiers spat out blood and lowered his gun. Once he had, all the rest did too. "What's in the bag?" "More explosives," Bishop said. The idea was to keep them talking. One of the fallen Company F crew screamed from somewhere under a pile of rubble, and Bishop looked at it, then back at the leader, Key Parker. "Do you want me to dig them out?" "No, I want you to take that bag of boom up top, tell them you're Bishop, get on board, and blow those bastards all to hell. We owe him that. That's an order, Rook. Take him out.
The timer said 20 seconds had elapsed since the explosion. Particulates were rising. He set his internal sensors to alert him when they reached significant enough levels to affect Parker. Of course, he said with the same flat delivery. Anything else?
Anything else? What the hell else could there be? Go!
Bishop angled his head up and said, The roof is unstable. You should move.
Fuck!
Parker looked around. Most of the hostages had survived. 3 of the children and 5 adults. 3 lay buried somewhere in the rubble with his other soldiers.
Get them up. All right, let's go. After you.
Bishop set a slow pace as the seconds ticked by. The alert flashed red in the corner of his vision, and he banished it with a blink as he turned to look behind him. Parker and his remaining soldiers were still on their feet, but they looked unsteady. Of the hostages, 2 of the children had fallen and been picked up by adults. The 3rd, older, swayed and clutched at the woman next to her. They were all gasping.
Brevox!
Parker managed to gasp, and he lunged past Rook to one of the life cabinets. He unlocked it with a flash of fingers on the pad, grabbed a mask, and put it over his face. Bishop saw him take in a breath, and then another, and another. Parker turned toward the synth he still thought was Rook. Bishop would never forget that look, that desperate, angry, terror-filled look. Not that he ever forgot anything, but Parker's expression seemed different. It seemed important.
I'm not Rook, and they're not working, Bishop told him.
He eased him to a sitting position. Parker managed to fumble off the mask. He was trying to breathe. He was breathing, but it didn't do any good. His skin had gone gray.
I have to save the ones I have for hostages. I'll help you too, just last.
Bishop took Parker's gun away and put it aside. The other Company F survivors had already fallen. So had all of the hostages. Bishop methodically took the weapons, then fitted the working masks on each of the hostages, starting with the smallest. There were extras, since some of those he'd intended to save were already dead. When he got back around to Parker, it was too late. Too late for his soldiers as well. I can't harm a human being, Bishop thought, but he hadn't. He'd simply prioritized helping in a logical way. It wasn't his fault that had resulted in someone's death. But, he thought, better the pirates than the prisoners. He wasn't altogether sure he should be making those kinds of judgments. He didn't know who to ask what was right and wrong in this case. He picked up 2 of the children, 1 in each arm, and set off at a run for the surface. They'd left a dropship for him, but the Marines were gone, and for good reason. The ground itself was unstable. Bishop's monitors reported multiple system failures due to the explosion in the converters. It was only a matter of time before the entire thing went up in a fireball. If the reactor didn't blow, then the oxygen supplies would as soon as the still-raging fire reached them. Bishop made 3 trips, carrying 2 at once, and as he came back for the last 2 masked survivors, he found them dead. Also, he found them without masks. Their faces gray and still, mouths open and eyes shining silver from Prevox poisoning. He was still trying to understand what had happened when he was shot in the back. Bishop didn't know what pain felt like to a real person, but to him it felt like a burning sensation that cut through him like a hot blade from back to front. Through skill, planning, or blind luck, the bullet tumbled through a Nexus cluster and he felt his right side go limp and dead, and he crumpled to the ground and rolled onto his back. 2 of the Company F soldiers stood over him, guns aimed down at his chest. They were wearing masks, the masks he'd put on the hostages. That was a surprise. His face registered an emotion, but he wasn't sure how that looked. A tragedy comedy mask split like Lieutenant Larson's down the middle? The pain hadn't stopped, his synthetic brain reported. Dying is painful. That was an interesting fact. He wondered if he was afraid.
His hydraulic system was redlining, as it had when he was running top speed, though he could hardly move at all. His tongue felt dry. He felt a cold trickle of fluid underneath his body. Bleeding. Leaking. Is there a difference? Fucking synth, one of them said from under her mask and kicked him very hard, but on the side he couldn't feel. Surprised? We had an air pocket under the rubble that saved us, and we found these. She tapped the mask she wore. Thanks for that.
Thanks for nothing, you freak,
the other one, a man, said. They both aimed their weapons. At this range, those would shred him apart. Bishop tried to speak. With half his mouth working, he wasn't sure it was very successful. Sorry, he told them, which was an odd thing to say, and he was sure he was malfunctioning because he recognized the feeling that swept over him. It was hot and uncontrollable and almost human in its intensity, and all he knew in that moment was, if they leave here, they'll slaughter the hostages. And it was a moral dilemma that he was not programmed to handle. Until he programmed himself. He opened his sync link to the masks and turned them off. He saw the exact moment that they realized they couldn't breathe, that they'd taken in lethal gulps of prevox-laden air. He expected them to shoot, but instead they dropped their weapons and grabbed for the masks, slapping them as if that would make them work, then wrenching them off to try to gasp clean air that didn't exist, and then... He closed his eyes and didn't watch the rest. There was a new feeling. Guilt. For his last action, Bishop synced to the dropship, put it on autopilot, and ordered it to dust off with the survivors he'd loaded inside. He kept tracing it until it was too far up for the sync to work, and then he had to believe that it would reach the ship, that Lieutenant Larson would understand that he had done his job for the Marines. I prioritized, he told himself. I didn't kill anyone. I prioritized, and I protected. That was important. If he ever told anyone what he'd done, they'd flush him, execute him. But then again, he was going to die here well before that. There was nothing else to be accomplished. Bishop went to power save mode. He slept. When he booted awake again, he was in a medbay and someone had their fingers in his back, probing, moving aside hydraulic tubes and connecting hair-thin wires with sharp little snaps of feeling, and suddenly, Bishop was online, fully online. Healed.
Yeah, that's got it,
said a new voice, a strange voice, and the intrusive fingers left his body and smoothed skin back in place. He felt the cut being sealed and rolled over to sit up. The Marine who'd repaired him took a wide step back, holding out both hands.
Whoa, whoa, peace, I'm friendly, man.
So am I, Bishop said. Hello, where's Lieutenant Larson?
Reassigned, said a big man with a wide grin and an unlit cigar in his mouth. Said for us to check. Said there was a synth on Ha'arsa that might still be salvageable, and since we lost ours a couple of trips back...
He had a sharp look in his eyes, Bishop thought.
You're not one of those A2 models, right?
No, Bishop said. I'm three generations later, D4. My designation is HS17B48XG5-D5.
And what do they call you when you're home?
Bishop, he said and smiled. My name is Bishop.
I like it. Suits you, Synth.
I prefer the term artificial person, sir.
A pwn, Sergeant. Don't call me sir. I'm not a damn officer. Just Sergeant or a pwn or both. You got me, Bishop?
Yes, Sergeant.
Good.
Sergeant Apone held out his hand. Bishop stared at it for several seconds, then reached out and offered his own. He was careful not to crush the man's hand when they shook.
Welcome to the team, Bishop. This fool's Private Hudson.
Aw, Sarge, I didn't know you cared.
Shut up, Hudson.
Hudson gave Bishop a wide grin, all teeth.
He says shut up, but I hear keep talking.
He offered his hand for shaking, too. Odd. In all his life, Bishop had never been treated like an equal. Not like that. Now, twice. You ever played five-finger fillet? Bishop shook his head. Apone rolled his eyes, chomped his cigar, and said, You break him, you buy him, Hudson. He crossed his arms and leaned against the wall to watch, though, not interfering. Hudson pulled out a knife. You're gonna love this game. And he was right. I think I'm broken, Bishop thought as he slammed the knife faster and faster between his spread fingers to Hudson's crows of delight. For no reason, he remembered Dr. Sasaki's finger hovering over a data tablet, ready to send him to recycle, and his hand blurred even faster until his eyes could barely track it. Maybe I've always been broken. That was all right. It made him happy.
Reclamation by Yvonne Navarro. The first time Dwayne Hicks saw the woman he would ask to marry him was in the cantina on base, after his graduation from boot camp. He had made a lot of friends in the Colonial Marines, both before and after signing up, and he'd sworn he wouldn't be like them, hooked up with the first cute face he met, and most definitely not another jarhead, while his plans to explore space on the government's payroll went down the drain thanks to a ring and a couple of kids. Then he saw Rachel Miller 15 feet away, just as she slammed the point of her K-bar into the table in front of her, right through the hand of the guy who'd run his palm down the curve of her uniform to backside. How could he not fall in love with a woman like that? Private First Class Rachel Miller became Private First Class Rachel Miller Hicks, not quite 8 weeks later, in a small ceremony in the base chapel. They had their first sergeant's approval, with the explicit understanding that there would be no special treatment. A Marine was a Marine, and they would do what they were told. The only concession to their status was they would be stationed together. They each got 2 rank promotions and spent 11 great months with each other before Rachel's squad got sent on a mission to investigate a small moon believed to be hiding pirated spacecraft. No big deal, she told Hicks. The ship's called the Paradox. 2 months to get there, a week or two to find out what's going on and clean it up, 2 months back. 6 months at the most. We got this. The first time Hicks got a video message from Rachel was 7 weeks in, at the end of her squad's hypersleep. The grainy black-and-white image on his screen showed his dark-haired wife with her short hair flattened around her head like a halo. 49 days of not moving your head will do that. She looked groggy as she rubbed her face, trying to bring sensation back, and she was the most beautiful thing Hicks had ever seen, even though he was seeing the past. Standard transmission time from her locale to Earth was about 12 hours. Hi, baby. Just woke up, so I hope this makes sense. We're 5 or so days out. Gunny says nothing new came in about the place while we were under. If it's been quiet all this time, I'm not sure what the big deal is. But hey, I just follow orders. Hoorah! Rachel stopped and rubbed her face again, then grinned at the vid camera. Glad I don't grow hair on my face. The rest of these guys look like scraggly apes. I'll send another message tomorrow. Love you. He couldn't answer her, but her messages to him came in like they were on a timer. And if they weren't exactly exciting, they were reassuring in their sameness. Hi, baby. Nothing new on the moon front, just that bare piece of rock getting closer in the view screen, and us doing prep. Like Mom always says, no news is good news, right? Out until tomorrow. Love you. There wasn't much for an E3 in the core to do at night, other than drink and raise hell, but although Hicks had a long way to go before he became an old married man, he did want to be home each night when Rachel's transmission finally came through. His evenings became as routine as his wife's were, somewhere in the vastness of space. His duty day ended. He ate a plate or two of unidentifiable slop at the mess hall. Then he went home. There he shucked his uniform, showered, and sat in front of the television until the comm program chimed. On this particular Tuesday evening, he wasn't expecting anything different. Of course, when you're least expecting it, is when the shit always falls out of nowhere. Hi, baby. Gunny says this has to be quick. We're down on the surface. Been here for about 5 hours, I guess. But we haven't found anything yet. We have a location lock on a ship's beacon, but it's another 60 clicks. Not sure if it's a valid vessel or pirated, but I guess we'll find out. The Rachel on screen tonight was geared up and rolling in full kit. Helmet, body armor, eye gear, weapons. Hicks didn't know why the sight suddenly unnerved him. After all, he'd